This is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty. Another round of U.S. sanctions on Iran go into effect Monday, this time targeting the country's oil and banking sectors. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, appearing Sunday in the program Face the Nation, said the aim is to persuade what he called the terror regime to end its bad behavior.
These sanctions apply to those who conduct sanctionable transactions. The Treasury has a set of sanctions. The State Department has its own set of sanctions. And those will all come back into place on Monday of this week. And they'll be the toughest sanctions ever placed against the Islamic Republic of Iran.
The move comes after the U.S. pulled out of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal in May. Some European and Asian companies have already begun cutting back on purchases of Iranian oil.
The European companies will not be permitted to do business with both the United States and with Iran. Frankly, since May, since the president's announcement of withdrawal from the ill-fated agreement, European companies have fled Iran in great numbers. Hundreds of businesses have departed Iran.
The Trump administration is reportedly exempting several countries from the sanctions, although Pompeo did not reveal which ones. In Iran, thousands marched chanting death to America Sunday, marking the 39th anniversary of the storming of the U.S. Embassy and taking of 52 Americans hostage for 444 days. In a speech on Saturday, Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei said America's goal to reestablish its dominance has failed. America has been defeated by the Islamic Republic for 40 years. Egyptian security forces said they killed at least 19 Islamist militants from a group believed to have been responsible for an attack on Coptic Christians in Minya province in central Egypt that left 7 dead. Egypt Sunday said the firefight occurred after a pursuit in the mountainous region west of Minya. This is VOA News. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo Sunday said he'll meet with his North Korean counterpart Kim Jong-chol in New York later this week.
I'll be in New York City at the end of this week meeting with my counterpart Kim Jong-chol. I expect we'll make some real progress, including an effort to make sure that the summit between our two leaders can take place where we can make substantial steps towards denuclearization.
At the first summit in June, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un pledged to President Donald Trump that he would work toward denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Friday, Pyongyang warned it could restart development of its nuclear program if the U.S. does not drop its campaign of maximum pressure of sanctions. Pompeo insisted there will be no economic relief until the ultimate objective has been achieved. A majority of voters in the South Pacific French territory of New Caledonia voted to remain part of France instead of opting for independence. Turnout among eligible voters was nearly 81%. In the end, less than 57% chose to remain with France, while less than 44% preferred independence.
Mes chers compatriotes, au plan politique, il n'y a pas d'autre chemin.
French President Emmanuel Macron praised the people of New Caledonia for their confidence in the French Republic, vowing to continue dialogue on the political future of the archipelago of some 270,000. The U.S. has warned its citizens in Tanzania to be cautious in the wake of a crackdown on homosexuals, a crime in the southern African country. President John Magufuli has engaged in a harsh position since coming to power in 2015. Dar es Salaam Governor Paul Makonda has called on citizens to report acts of homosexuality to authorities. Amnesty International condemned the operation as regrettable and dangerous. Fighting has intensified around Yemen's Red Sea port city of Hodeidah between coalition forces backing the government and rebel Houthi defenders. General Mohammed bin Salah said the city, a vital lifeline for millions, has been surrounded and operations will continue until it is liberated. Dozens have reportedly been killed. Kenyan runner Mary Katani won her fourth New York City Marathon Sunday in 2 hours, 22 minutes, 48 seconds, the second fastest time ever.
I was not thinking of course about, but I was saying, okay, let me try to win.
Ethiopia's Lalisa Desisa won the men's race, his first after winning the Boston Marathon twice, in 2 hours, 5 minutes, 59 seconds. The mayor of North Ogden, Utah, Brent Taylor, was an apparent victim of a so-called insider attack, fatally shot by an Afghan trainee Saturday in Afghanistan. The military intelligence officer, the father of seven, was expected to return home in January. Another American was wounded in the incident. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbwate in Washington. Today is Monday, November 5th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. The Cameroon government says all is set for President Paul Biya's 7th inauguration tomorrow, Tuesday.
The swearing-in ceremony is under intense and acute preparation. All the pieces of the puzzle are being put in place in order to make this ceremony one of the best ever held in our nation.
Issa Chiroma-Bakari is Cameroon's information minister. Eswatini's new cabinet begins work today, but the banned opposition Podemo says the cabinet is based on nepotism. A Somali town receives health care after nearly three decades of conflict, and Nigeria's military defends its interaction with the country's Shiite movement.
The military has never been used to stop Shiite movement from protesting. But because Shiite movement never recognized Nigerian state, whenever they see the military in the course of their duty, they are always ready to obstruct the military from doing their job.
Brigadier General John Ajima is the Nigerian defense spokesman. There is a new determination to end violence against journalists in East Africa. And we'll tell you about the rape culture in a town in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. President Paul Biya will tomorrow, Tuesday, take his 7th oath of office in the capital, Yaoundé. Mr. Biya was declared winner of the October 7th presidential election with over 71% of the total votes cast. Opposition candidate Maurice Kamto, who came second, has called for the setting up of an independent international committee to supervise a recount of the results. Cameroon's Constitutional Court last month dismissed a petition by Kamto and other opposition parties calling for the annulment of the results. Issa Chiroma-Bakari, Cameroon's information minister, says Kamto and other losing candidates must respect the rule of law. He says Cameroonians are ready for tomorrow's inauguration.
The swearing-in ceremony is under intense and acute preparation. All the pieces of the puzzle are being put in place in order to make this ceremony one of the best ever held in our nation.
What do you say to Mr. Maurice Kamto? He still thinks that there should be an international committee set up to supervise a recount of the ballots.
We are a democratic nation where the freedom of press, freedom of speech is acknowledged. He has lost the election. There is no doubt about it. Mr. B has scored five times the result of Mr. Kamto. So, no problem. He's free to say what he wants, but he understands that his responsibility is to abide by the law.
Minister, he says that the Constitutional Council that declared President Paul Biya the winner was biased in favor of the president.
He knows the constituent of the electoral body that we call elector. If he disagrees with their composition, was not obliged to introduce an application and to run for the presidential election. Let him not ridicule himself. Cameroonians are very well aware. Now he became a tool into the hand of those who would like to destabilize this nation. He became a daydreamer. I am sorry to say this, but this is just what he is, daydreamer.
I think now the people of the English-speaking region will be looking up to President Paul Biya to see what he would do to bring the country together. Because your country right now, I would say, is divided.
The country is not divided at all. Unfortunately, a handful of violent secessionists have taken hostages our brothers and sisters in the two regions. But we are very much grateful that many of them overcome their fear. And they went to the polling station to cast their ballot, and this has taken place. Unfortunately, the turnout has not been one we wish to be. But those who were courageous enough to do it, they went there, and we are very much delighted. Election has taken place in the two regions, and the result is already known.
Minister Chiroma-Bakari, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to speak with you on Daybreak Africa.
Merci beaucoup. Merci. Toutes mes amitiés. Merci beaucoup. Thank you.
Isa Chiroman Bakari is Cameroon's Minister of Information. He was speaking with me from the capital, Yaoundé. The Nigerian military has been explaining whether it retweeted a video in which U.S. President Donald Trump reportedly said that if migrants threw rocks at U.S. military, the U.S. military will fight back. The Nigerian military has been accused of killing as many as 40 Shiite marchers over the last week. Amnesty International has criticized the Nigerian military for a strong-handed response. Brigadier General John Ajim, the Nigerian defense spokesman, says at least 6 people were killed and 7 wounded. He said the Shiites attempted to stop the Nigerian military from doing its job and that no country in the world would allow that to happen to its military.
Let me say that the military has never been used to stop child movement from protesting. But because child movement never recognized Nigerian state, whenever they see the military in the course of their duty, they are always ready to obstruct the military from doing their job. And I want to believe that there is no country in any part of the world that their chief of army staff will be obstructed from doing official duty. And their life will be at risk in doing that duty, that they will allow it to go free.
Did the army put on its Twitter account this video of President Trump? And then with the quote here that we have, please watch and make your own deductions. Did the army put that video on, and what was the purpose of it?
The director of army corporations, they posted out the Trump video account where he said that if anybody used tools on the American military, they should reply back with a rifle. Now, here we have child movements. They are using petrol bombs. They are using rifles. Is it actually true that they don't have arms, or is some people who are sponsoring them to destabilize Nigerian security, they are putting those narratives? Because the police arrested them with petrol bombs. They arrested them with stones. They arrested them with nails that they welded together, which they are using to aim at security agents. And the Nigerian military have never been used to stop their protests. If there's anybody that will talk about the issue of protests, it's the Nigerian police. And the Nigerian police have arrested them having some arms and ammunition when they are in protest. And they're taking them to court. Why should Amnesty International come out to say that they were not armed? Is it true that they do everything to ensure that they paint the Nigerian security agents black so that they don't have support when they are fighting terrorism and insurgency? That is the question we want to find out.
I did speak to a spokesman for the Islamic movement who indicated to me as many as 40 people died. What is the true number?
The number of people that died were 6 people and 7 wounded. But Amnesty International sent out the press release that 45 of Shiite movement died and 132 wounded. So the narrative of Shiite movement, they are taking from what Amnesty International said. Amnesty International, right from 2012 to 2013, they have insisted that no country should support Nigeria in the fight against the insurgents, because if you support Nigeria, security agents will use the weapons against their citizens.
You said that the Shiite do not recognize the Nigerian state. How does the Nigerian government recognize the Shiite? Are they Nigerians or are they what?
We have shared movement that look at Iran as a spiritual headquarters of their movement. We have shared that they disagree with Al-Zazaki group and they are having their own groups. They refuse to disorganize and destabilize Nigeria.
Brigadier General John Ajim is the Nigerian defense spokesman. He was speaking with me from the capital, Abuja. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today's Monday, November 5th. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. The International Organization for Migration, IOM, has begun providing life-saving health care to 2 Somali towns previously inaccessible because of war and conflict. This was made possible after the government recently liberated the towns of Gobwin and Bola Gadu in southeastern Somalia. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from IOM headquarters in Geneva.
Tens of thousands of people in the towns of Gobwein and Bulagadud have been deprived of life-saving health care for nearly three decades. These areas have been too dangerous for aid workers to reach because of the never-ending cycles of war and conflict in the area. In recent months, International Organization for Migration spokesman Joel Millman says government forces have succeeded in subduing the armed groups that have made life a misery for local inhabitants. This, he says, has opened up these areas to outside help.
For the past 27 years, war and conflict have made health care access difficult or impossible in many parts of the country. Now, these communities have access to vaccinations, malaria treatment, antenatal care for pregnant mothers, malnutrition screenings and referrals, among other essential health services.
Millman says aid agencies who finally were able to reach these towns were dismayed by the prevailing conditions. He says they found high levels of malnutrition and extremely poor immunization coverage. Because the towns had no humanitarian services, he says many people had abandoned their villages. He says they were living in overcrowded settlements in faraway urban centers where medical care was available. He says it is likely many of these displaced people will decide to return to their communities now that the life-saving aid they need can be had closer to home. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Eswatini, formerly Swaziland, the new 18-member cabinet announced last week by Prime Minister Ambrose Dlamini is expected to begin work today, Monday. Six members are women, including Princess Sikinyiso, the daughter of King Mswati III, Mario Masuku, leader of the band People's United Democratic Movement, known as PUDEMO, says the new cabinet is based on nepotism.
It is a strange composition of a cabinet, in that you have members of his family in there, which we were saying, we've always been saying, that give the people the power to elect a government of their own. We've got his daughter as a cabinet minister, but we are asking, where does he base the legitimacy of appointing a daughter? His brothers are in there. Fine. Having done that, we are all looking forward to a cabinet that will deliver to the people, but we know clearly that they are not answerable to the people anyway. The people have got no power to either withdraw or do anything in that cabinet.
The fact that the king has appointed six women as part of this cabinet, isn't that a credit to the king, the fact that he's trying to broaden the gender representation?
Yeah. We want women to have a say in leadership of any country, leadership of any organization, but not on favoritism, based on nepotism, based on authoritarianism. There are six women, and most of those women that are in there are his relatives. So there is no way I am going to give him a credit on a wrong formula of composition. You cannot find a good in a wrong formula.
Suppose King Mswati III had reached out to you and said, Mr. Masuku, I'd like for you to be a part of my cabinet. Would you accept?
I wouldn't, unfortunately for him, accept an appointment based on the current situation. It is a democratic process that is people-centered, that is answerable to the people, where the people are able to withdraw any person who does not deliver according to the people's mandate. We believe in a formula where political parties, based on the freedom of association, freedom of assembly, and of expression, are going to form a government of their choice, but not how he has done it.
Mr. Masuku, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to speak with you, and thank you again.
It has been my pleasure. Thank you.
Mario Masuku is leader of the band People's United Democratic Movement, PUDEMO Party. He was speaking with me from the Eswatini capital, Mbabane. Regional media houses are set to cooperate with the East African Assembly and the African Court on Human and People's Rights to end impunity on crimes committed against journalists. This comes after UNESCO wrote a letter inquiring into the status of investigations regarding the killing of journalists in East Africa. Moses Aviarimana reports from Arusha, Tanzania.
despite the strengthening of the international legal framework on safety of journalists over the past 5 years, through the adoption of more than 10 resolutions by the United Nations organization. 1,010 journalists and media workers have been killed since 2006. Sylvain Auré, the president of the African Court for People and Human Rights, says only two cases were handled by the court, including the case of investigative journalist Norbert Zongo, brought against the Burkina Faso government. Zongo was murdered in 1998, and his killing became the symbol against the government of then President Blaise Compaoré's rule.
The African Court of Human and People's Rights indeed received some cases, and we made some landmark decisions on freedom of expression and protection of journalists. The decision was that we cannot put journalists in jail because of what they have written.
According to UNESCO's World Trends on Freedom of Expression and Media Development 2017-2018 report, attacks and harassments of journalists, particularly online platforms, have increased significantly. Somalia is part of the list of countries where it is not safe for journalists, as at least 57 journalists were killed since 1992. Hassan Gese is the chairman of the Somali Independent Media Houses Association.
Somalia continues to be one of the dangerous countries to be a journalist. This year, only 2018, we lost 4 journalists. To be a journalist in Somalia, it's not easy. The main threat coming from mainly Al-Shabaab and also Somali government soldiers as well, but we are trying to sacrifice ourselves to inform our people.
Uganda has been the latest country where security forces have been accused of beating and torturing journalists. Ofwono Pondo is the spokesman of the Ugandan government.
We don't tolerate abuse of any kind. However, in the system, there will always be black sheep. But obviously, it has been a matter of concern that it appears to be recurring. The president has given direction about engagement with the media, and we hope the security agencies that have been the main abusers will heed.
Only 1 out of 10 of the cases of 1,010 journalists and media workers who were killed since 2006 were brought to court. After the meeting in Arusha, regional media and associations to protect journalists are expected to partner with the East African Legislative Assembly and the African Court to end impunity on crimes committed against journalists. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Arusha, Tanzania.
80% of the 2,600 victims of violence that Medecins Sans Frontières has treated in the town of Kananga in the Democratic Republic of Congo since May last year report having been raped by armed men. According to MSF, of the rape victims, 162 were children under the age of 15 and 22 of them were under the age of 5. Carol Jensen, MSF's head of mission in the DRC, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the level of sexual violence, which the group says is new to the area.
This is specific on Kasai Central. We have a team of Doctors Without Borders there since May 2017, providing different sorts of medical care and with one health center specifically for victims of sexual violence. And over the course of the past 16 months, we have seen more than 2,600 victims who came to our clinic. So we are new in Kasai Central, but these levels of violence in Kasai Central are new to us as well.
Of the 2,600 victims of sexual violence, 32 were men. My question is not just that they were men, but they seems that they were reported to having been forced under armed threat to rape members of their own community. So I can imagine that, is that something you've seen in other clinics? Because that seems like a very specific psychological violent tool of warfare to tear a community apart, really.
Yeah, so over 2,600 victims, and indeed amongst them, some children and also some men. And it shows the level of violence, and it also shows how this kind of violence will affect not only the people, the victims themselves, but also how it will affect communities, whole communities, for months and even years to come. And part of the reason why we are bearing witness today of this, of what we see in our health center, center there is also to appeal to have more actors and more attention going to the aftercare, socio-economic support for victims of sexual violence. So there's a whole care that has to be provided afterwards that currently is not there or way too little of it is available to victims.
You mentioned children as among those victims, and your report said that 22 of those were under the age of 5.
It's a level of violence that, if I can give you an example, there's this one woman who came to our clinic. She had her husband killed. She had her daughter being raped, and afterwards she was raped as well.
That was Kara Jansen, head of mission for Mets in San Frontier in the Democratic Republic of Congo. You're speaking to Ricky Stryker from Brussels. It's 25 minutes past the hour. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, James. We begin in New York City, where Mary Kitiani of Kenya and Lilisa Disisa of Ethiopia won the New York City Marathon on Sunday, with Mary Kitiani dominating the strong women's field for her fourth victory in the event, and Lilisa Disisa surging ahead of two other runners near the finish line. Disisa held off countryman Shura Kitita by 1.99 seconds for his first win in New York, joining victories at the Boston Marathon in 2013 and 2015. He missed second in New York in 2014 and third in 2015 and 2017. Lilisa Disisa finished in 2 hours, 5 minutes, 59 seconds, the second fastest time for the course in history.
I participate, number 2, number 3, and one time I DNF. This year, I decided to champion because I did hard training. Everything control. I save my power, and I saw athletes, especially my partner training athlete Shura Kitata. Amazing him.
In the women's category, Mary Kitiani, who won in 2014, 2015, and 2016 before coming in second last year behind American Shalane Flagan, joined Greater Worlds, who won the marathon 9 times between 1978 and 1988 as the only women to win the marathon 4 times. Mary Kitiani pulled away at the 19-mile mark and held a 1 hour, 27 minutes, 83-second lead at the 21-mile mark. From that point, the question was not whether Kitiani will win, rather it was by how much. She beat countrywoman Vivian Cheruiyot by 3 minutes 13 seconds.
I thank God for the victory. I'm really happy for winning today again for the fourth time. I know last year was second, and I did not give up. I go back home, I train, and I say, okay, next time I will try my best. And that's why I've come today and got a good weather for running.
And on to football news. The CAF Champions League final first leg match between Al Ahly of Egypt and Esperance of Tunisia was marred by controversial refereeing calls. There were 3 penalties on the night, including 2 controversial ones, which went to the Egyptians as Ahly sealed a 3-1 win that certainly didn't go down well with a travelling contingent. We stay in North Africa, where Egypt's Zamalek has been given a final 90-day deadline by FIFA to pay the dues of former players Alexis Mendomo if they are to avoid being deducted points in the Egyptian Premier League. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that is it for this Monday, November 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson Omale, along with our engineer Jamie Cook, I'm James Botti in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very, very productive week.
Hello, friends. This is Sunday Shomari, host of Let's Talk. Join me Monday for another exciting edition of your show. Our topic will be cooking. Is it a woman's job only? This will be Monday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
She said she too young, don't want no man.
Starting Monday, November 5th, tune into Border Crossings to win a free copy of Now 68, featuring top songs from a variety of artists. This CD features Calvin Harris's One Kiss, along with Ariana Grande's God is a Woman, and many other hit songs. Tune in to Border Crossings to win.